We'll be hearing now what we just did in other language. So I think we've covered a large chunk of this chapter in that review. Let's just go through it, because I do hope you can feel how important this is, and that we really do have an attempt of the psyche to generate a new image of God in this text. So 321, top of the page, the second paragraph, so far the parable seems to come closer to the generally accepted Christian views than does the earlier part of the text, that is all those biblical references. The reason for this must be that the author has separated himself from the black earth and has passed into a vision of the world beyond. But here in this passage, he communicates something portentously new. I'm hearing a funny noise. Did you push play?
It's been gone.
No, it sounded like rewinded.
That's record. But it is making a noise. Let me move it further away.
No, it doesn't bother me. I'm just wondering if you were recording there or if it was... Sounds like it's playing. Aren't you supposed to push two buttons for recording?
Of it.
There you go.
I'm guided.
See?
That's what I was pushing my good ears.
Thank you. I'd get there and there wouldn't be anything on it.
But here in the passage, he communicates something potentially new in the Holy of Holies, which the Christian may hope to enter only after death. He beholds not the Godhead, but the mysterium communicionis of the sun and the moon. Is it working? Mm-mm. Is it turned the right way?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I want you to have your tape.
It doesn't want to.
Maybe you should reverse it. Hmm? Take it out and shake. Maybe it's just the other way. I don't know.
Unions are intuitives.
Everybody knows how to work and shake
paper.
Can you have a look at it?
Yeah, I do look at it. See, I think this is supposed to go here, but I sent you at the half, the side, you know.
Oh, yes, Bob.
What?
You had it on voice activation.
Oh, did I?
Oh.
Is it going?
Ta-da!
Oh, okay, there you go.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the one sensation type in Jungian psychology. Are you?
Yeah.
I mean, trying to communicate with Jungians on email is just, and I'm bad, but they're terrible. So, mysterium communicionis of sun and moon, that's what we were talking about. The woman in the apocalypse is clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet. So this motif had already been foreshadowed in the earlier appearance of the anima. Now, can we just take a moment and compare those two images? In the apocalypse, you have the sun-moon conjunction in her. Remember I mentioned that she's there at the end of the text. But, you see, she's in danger, the child is in danger of being devoured. But you don't see that is in danger of being devoured here. So that is the indication of the shift in the strength of cultural consciousness, to be able to receive this new light. An authentic parallel to the image in Aurora would be the vision of the heavenly Jerusalem as the bride adorned for her husband in Apocalypse 21, blah, blah, where the city is described as the Lamb's wife. The light that emanates from the city was like unto a stone most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. But the only thing that really adds is it's a comparison to that earlier Revelation image, where there was an attempt at communicatio, but not necessarily successful. I think that can take us over to 323.
Just a quick question.
They talk about the parable of Marcos. Is that how we say that, Marcos?
I don't know.
Marcia? Is that the same as the Marcosians?
I don't know. Where is that?
Well, later on she talks about the Marcosians. I think it's a Gnostic sect. And are those is that referring to this Marcos?
I'd have to check.
Okay. Just curious.
I can check that. It's a parable of Marcos in Senior, quoted by Jung. So I have to look at that. 36:72.
I looked at that, but I couldn't figure out.
Where are you reading, Carol?
323, the middle of the bottom paragraph.
Oh, I see.
I'm just curious as to whether this Marcos, if that's how you say it, is who they refer to when they say the Marcosians. Except there's no H in Marcosian.
Mm-hmm. I'll check. Three 23, for it is founded. Now the it there would be the brightness of the sun and the moon.
Now, is that, Gary, just going back, is that the union of the Mother of God with Christ? Is that what they're referring to by... You know, when they talk about in 321, the Mother of God with Christ in heavenly bridal chambers, you know, I mean, the marriage union?
It's a similar theme, but with differences. In the revelation image, that light is really from God in the text. So even though it's a union, the illumination isn't from the union. The illumination is from God. But in this text, the illumination is from the union. That's the difference. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess that's just what I was trying to... So that is what they're talking about then? When he talks about the Mother of God and Christ being married?
What
he's talking about here?
Well, that's a first attempt to produce the union of the sun and the moon.
Okay, but is that possibly maybe the image of like Christianity moving into the, you know, coming into the feminine?
In the biblical image?
Right.
Yes, definitely. But see, it doesn't occur because of the dragon.
Okay, because it's taken up to heaven.
Because if that development comes down to earth, it gets devoured. So it's the same dynamism at different stages.
So that's our job now, is to bring that down to earth, to bring that in.
Right.
Yeah.
You could say in other language that the light of the sun and the moon, the light begotten of the sun and the moon, in this vision would be equivalent to that child coming down to earth.
Right.
Yeah. But so here the it is the light of the alchemical union. For it is founded upon a sure rock. Okay, because it's the house that's on that rock, right? Now it gets a little weird. Which cannot be split unless it be anointed with the blood of a most fine buck goat. Or be smitten three times with the rod of Moses, that the waters may flow forth in great abundance, that all the people, both men and women, drink thereof, and they shall neither hunger nor thirst anymore. Whosoever by his science shall open this house shall find therein an unfailing living font that maketh young, wherein whoever is baptized shall be saved and can no more grow old. So what this is going to be is a development of the symbolism of the house. The foundation of that house is meant to become a source for, in the text, for humanity, if you take that internally, for the individual who's experiencing this, for the rejuvenation of their own life. And if you take it as the external dimension of the conjunctio, does that phrase make sense? The external dimension of the conjunctio, we'll be talking about that. If it doesn't make sense now, hopefully it will. As the influence that you produce on the world when you've got your head on. Right. So although the unshakability of the rock is praised, the unexpected demand is now made that it should be split by anointing it with the blood of a buck goat or by the rod of Moses, so that the foundation of life shall flow forth. The rock is evidently both the foundation of the house and something found in the house, as well as the house itself. There's some good symbolic logic for you. It is the lapis philosophorum. The goat's blood with which it is opened is probably a borrowing from the parable of Marcos and Senior, quoted by Jung. There it signifies the flowing soul of the stone, a synonym for the divine water. You want to try and put that in your own words?
Which part?
the flowing soul of the stone.
That reminds me of the grail symbology with the blood symbolizing arrows and
the feminine. So and remember, this is symbolic logic, so it's not going to make logical sense, but we'll try to look at it in totality and then make sense of it. Because she's going to say the blood of the goat means two things. On the one hand, it means the sacred. So it would be the end state. The developed and conscious personality. But look at the bottom of the page. She's referring to another author, Pincinellus. That the stone, now I go down to the bottom, symbolizes the morally irreproachable man. Not the stone, sorry, the blood. The morally irreproachable man who could only be undone by, it does mean the stone, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
The stone can only be undone, but the important thing of our process is by the goat's blood of lust. Top 324. So they're just, she's just quoting two different alchemists who take blood in the exactly the opposite way. One says it's the redeemed condition, and the other says it's the, crude desire.
That's what we had with the grail, too, isn't it?
How do you mean?
Well, on the one hand, it was a spiritual essence, and on the other hand, it was a desire and everything from the dark element that was missing as the dark element. On the one hand, it was Christ's spiritual essence, the blood.
And I see,
the
because,
other hand,
of, yeah.
Cupiscentia.
Because of the relation to the stag. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. As you can see a definite parallel between these two texts. When was the Grail? It was about the same time, maybe a little earlier probably, in 12th, 11th century, I think. 12th century, got going. In its dual significance as benevolence and that benevolence and love on the one hand and lust and dissipation on the other, it represents an animal and emotional factor in man that has to be included in the process so that a living effect can stream forth from the sure rock of the spiritually stable personality. That's the point we're trying to get to. And somebody asked last time, well, you know, isn't Thomas pretty well spiritually integrated? Why do you talk that the self has to start with instinct and move up the spiritual ladder, so to speak? Well, here's the reason. Because it can be undone. He could be undone. What he could be undone with is the goat's blood. I think there, I would think of the goat's blood, you know, as the lasciviousness of the billy goat. And what in the world does that have to do with spirituality? Well, we've seen in this Aurora text that the psychological spiritual task is this transformation from low to high. That's all. Nothing new. You see, we're just kind of embellishing. That takes us over to 327. And she just recapitulates there on the second page, sorry, on the second line of 327. Therefore, the stone must be softened with the goat's blood. It has to be able to absorb the instinct and not fall apart.
What has to be able to absorb?
Well, if you take the stone as the consolidated condition that we're seeking to achieve, we've got to be able to absorb the instincts and not be undone by them. If I remember, the classic story there would be E.M. Forster's Passage to India. Remember that? She goes to India and she sees all those sexual statues in their temples and she falls to pieces. But the Victorian morality, it's such a veneer, because if you get nearby real desire, you're just swept up by it. And the goal, one of the goals of development is that you can be on such good terms with your desirousness that in the face of this beautiful sexual, sensual invitation, it's not that you want it and you are repressing yourself from getting it, but you say, well, I've been there and I want something else now. And that's, I think, what it means to soften the stone with the goat of the blood.
It's interesting that they're using kind of like that rock about softening, because so much of it is, even in the biblical sense, is like harden not your heart. Mm-hmm. I mean, that whole thing is because this, to me, what I'm kind of experiencing, you can harden really easy to this stuff. Mm. But as far as not wanting to going further.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I can see his, you know, so you do need that softening, mm-hmm. you know, in order to continue,
mm-hmm.
to keep soft.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just a hardness that, you know, I mean.
Yeah, that's what we're dealing with today, right? I mean, you see that hardness all over the place.
I've seen it in my own life, period. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that, you know, just, that's been my whole thing this week is just trying to, you know, bring that softness, you know, mm-hmm. grace.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, I'm talking on.
The web goes everywhere.
Yeah.
Now, we enter into a new dimension, which I will read you and then try to explain. go down a couple of lines. This intuitive vision. See where I am? Mm-hmm. So, if you remember, we have this image of the house, right? We have this sense that house, it, as far as his unconscious is concerned, is being perceived as God. And we have the sense that perception of God is of an image that's different. That's the basic idea so far. But that he hasn't achieved that. He's begun to understand it or see it, but he hasn't achieved it. which is the way consciousness happens. You begin to be able to formulate what you're doing. You can describe what you're doing. You can say you don't want to do it, and then there's a cake on the table, and you have three pieces. What is happening in that process is you are beginning to develop consciousness over the complex. That's what in alchemical language is called the unio mentalis, and I will now try to explain it. This intuitive vision of the self corresponds to the stage of the unio mentalis in Dorn, which has still to be united with the body by means of the art and with the aid of human blood. The goat's blood in our text represents, as it were, the soul of the goat and symbolizes the animal man. The mythological connection of the goat with the Egyptian god Set and the devil with black magic and the chthonic world is too well known to need further amplification here. The animal world is the solvent by which the rock, the self, is drawn into a new process of development. Now let's just talk about Dorn for a minute, and then I'll come back to explain that passage. Dorn was an alchemist. Some of you might remember this from Mysterium. He was German, I think, 16th century. And he said, he lays out in his little mythological schema, that this union we are talking about occurs in three steps. The first step, he calls it, when I say the union we were talking about, he's speaking as an alchemist, the union of the sun and the moon, or of the opposites in the alchemical material, in his mythological mind, occurs in three steps. The first step is what he calls the unio mentalis. The second step is called the unio corporalis. And the third step is the unus mundus. In his mind, let's just think alchemically for a second, then we'll try to interpret it. In his mind, when you are cooking in that vessel, a spirit is extracted that stands vis-a-vis the chaos in the material that you're cooking. Remember, they think this material is alive. And that spirit is a kind of an understanding. All this their thinking is going on in the material, but Jung, of course, takes it as a metaphor. That an understanding is extracted from the material. And then if you cook it further, and that's what he calls the unio mentalis, the one mind. A mind is created. And if you cook it further, that unio mentalis goes back and joins the material again. And that's the unio corporalis, the one body, and that's the synthesis. That is a synthesis. There's a separation and synthesis, separation and synthesis. So the unio mentalis is a separation, unio corporalis is a synthesis of that previous separation. Now what that means psychologically, as Jung takes it as a metaphor, is that consciousness begins by developing an attitude of understanding and control. What we try to do at first is try to control our behavior. And that leads to an improved capacity for choice. You know, and the images that come across in dreams, very interestingly, they often look gruesome, and unless you know this symbolism, they're very easy to misinterpret, of heads being chopped off. It's surprisingly not an infrequent dream image of decapitation. And what that means is your understanding is separating from the affect that used to control it. That's the unio mentalis. So if you look at it as the constituents of the material, there's a separation in the warring elements of the material. If you look at it in other ways, and it is literally simple, you'll see this picture in many alchemical texts of the head being cut off, being separated. So you're trying to get some objectivity over your emotions and your drives and your complexes and your feelings and your obsessions. And that's what Dorn and what Jung calls the first stage of the conjunctio. And that's what we have here. He's beginning to see the new thing. Now, the problem with that is if you deal with it in an individual, it makes you a little stiff. Because you can control yourself, but you lose the vitality of the previous condition. Because there was vitality in those emotions. You may have, you know, you may have been a drunk, but you were interesting.
Even to yourself.
Even to yourself. And some people sober up and their life's so boring because they are controlling that stuff they used to live from. I think in AA, this would be the dry mouth syndrome. Dry mouth. Isn't that something you say in AA?
Dry drunk.
No, dry mouth. Where they are actually thirsty all the time. Mm. Not just for booze. Just for water. No. For liquid. No, never heard of that.
That's also when you're initiated, too. You know, I mean, as far as that.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Huh. Part of, like, food disorders, that type of thing.
Oh. I know some alcoholics who quit drinking, and they are thirsty all the time, not just for booze. And when they talk, you can hear there is no saliva in their mouth. Mm-hmm. They're very thick. And it's because they are getting a hold of that vitality, sick vitality, but it's vitality nonetheless, that energy, and they're beginning to control it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how far AA takes you. It's a very good separatio. Mm-hmm. It's another way to put it. It's a separation of understanding and affect, understanding behavior, understanding and need, understanding and drive. You start to be able to control yourself where before you couldn't. To see and control yourself where before you couldn't. As far as Dorn's concerned, that's only the first step. The second step is you take that understanding and you reunite it with the material world. Now, this would be what I would say Married Women is talking about by embodiment. That you begin to reconnect your understanding and your emotion. Putting it very simply, that if you're a drunk who has given up alcohol, you can go into a bar and have an interesting evening. You can go back to that vitality, but not, so you have both the vitality and the control and the understanding.
Did you say reconnect?
Well, it's, in their mind, it's in the alchemist mind, it would be reconnecting the unio mentalis with the material, or the unio corporalis, the one body. And that is, you begin to recover the vitality from the emotions that you first learned to control. So you go back to the very things you separated from, but now with the ability not to fall into them, but to work with them. And that is no small potato. Because I have, as a young person, I have mistakenly said to people, now go back to that dream image and see what it says, and they fall right into it. If it's an angry image, they get angry and they get into trouble. If it's a sexual image, they go out and they act out their sexuality. So before you can bring somebody back to the very emotions you work so hard to keep them away from, you got to make sure they have the strength not to fall into them. But that is the second goal, that you go back to the thing you separated from and you connect with it and enliven it. But now it's a healthy emotion because you don't let it drive you into pathological behavior. But that is a big deal, believe me. And many people are happy just in the unio mentalis stage, get control of it, see you, thank you very much, my life's back on track, goodbye.
Is that like mainstream?
That's Trinitarian mainstream psychology. Right. How to succeed, how to get control of yourself, how to be a winner. If you've been a loser all your life, that looks pretty good. But if you are somehow possessing another passion, you get bored. You're healthy, but you're bored. And you're boring, quite frankly. And so what this is getting yourself back into the vitality that when you felt it before was sick, but now you try to get it in a healthy way. And of course, the dreams sort of lead you through that.
And when you say you have to have the strength, you're talking about ego strength.
Ego strength, okay. Yeah. Ego strength, right. So you could say the unio mentalis is a development of ego strength, and unio corporalis is the production of the self, and that's the second stage. Yeah.
It's a collection of the self.
Well, see, it's a union, and out of that union comes a new identity that can both have emotions and understanding. But that is only the second stage, and this is where I think it's very interesting. He thinks there's a third stage. So I'm introducing to you now, we're going to see these stages of the conjunctio appear throughout the next several chapters. So I'm giving you a preview. This chapter we're just dealing with the unio mentalis, but if you know this, then I can just say, oh, here we are in the unio mentalis, here we are in the unio corporalis, here we are in the unis mundus. Now the unis mundus, let's go back to the alchemical mind. Dorn felt when you made that union right in yourself. In the material, because he's not thinking psychologically. When that union is made right in the vessel, the whole world in that vessel is in order. And it magically extends to the whole world. Of course, this never happened. But in his fantasy, he was saying, if you produce the gold in the vessel, the whole world will come in order. That's what he was saying. It's magical thinking. And Jung says that itself is a metaphor for the third dimension of our work. And that is when you do actually synthesize your sun and your moon, to go back to our earlier metaphor, that will have effects not only inside you, but outside you. Namely, synchronicity. And if you are on a complete journey, you will not want to stop until you see how your integration affects the world. And that's where I think it is so beautiful. Because this inner journey, which was once self-preoccupation, if you follow it to the max, it will lead you out to the world. And the joy you had giving to yourself becomes the joy you have giving to the world. There is no difference between working on your inner process and working on your outer world, because they're the same thing at the deepest level. When you know what your inner world is and you find in the outer world what is appropriate to your inner world, they're not separate anymore. And so your inner union will affect the vitality of the people around you. It will lead to work in the outer world. It will lead to generosity in the outer world, and this will also be accompanied by synchronicity. The world, it's like you come to the world, but the world comes to you too. If you don't mess it up, if you are true to the process, growth, this archetype of the conjunctio has three phases. Separation, union within, and then union between the within and without.
So if you can hold that vision or hold the tension, so you can get, is that what that, because there's...
Yeah, first you have to hold the tension between the conflict and yourself. Mm-hmm. But then you've got to know that integration is not finished until you have found your place in the world. And just as the inner process led you to find the synthesis within yourself, it will also lead you to find your relationship to the outer world. And that relationship to the outer world will be an outer synthesis which matches the inner synthesis. Again, my impatience with this spirit and matter split, that you do your inner work and then you do your outer work, because at the third level of the conjunctio, the third stage of the conjunctio, they are exactly the same. And at that point, I mean, I think we're all pretty comfortable with the fact that dream images can occur outside ourselves in synchronicities. And we're also pretty probably, if you've done any work, you're familiar with the fact that the inner world asks you to do things in the form of dream images. You have a responsibility to these images to do what it takes to integrate them. But in the third stage of the conjunctio, you realize that the outer world gives you images to work on, just like your dreams give you images to work on. There's no distinction between the inner and the outer world. You interpret the outer world as subjectively as you interpret your dreams. So you begin to realize the psyche is everywhere. And this, to me, is the overcoming of what we're calling today narcissism.
Is that why he couldn't integrate this, so he died? I mean, basically, is that what happened?
Well, he probably died from an injury, but he certainly would not have been able to integrate it. Because, you see, he is stuck at, and as is Christianity, is stuck at the level of the unio mentalis. So, and that's my great problem with Christianity. Goodness is a should. But when you're at the third stage of the conjunctio, goodness is an is. You don't do it because you should do it. You do it because that is the nature of who you are. And it may have its immoral aspects. It may have its moral aspects. It will be complicated. You know, I was talking to somebody who was just sort of getting young, and they said, well, what about this Tony Wolf stuff? You know, wasn't he a bastard? Well, no, actually, I don't think he was a bastard. But he had a very complicated life. He worked his ass off, and having two women was part of it. It all fits together. But also we have 40 volumes. You don't get a nice, clean end of story. You get a journey with mistakes and problems, and also you get a desire to contribute to the world simply because you want to contribute to the world. And I would say the deeper you go into the process, the more what you contribute is what the historical moment needs. In the end, it ends up looking very Christian. That's what's so weird. He talks a great length about the value of Christian ethics. But with Christianity, where it's morality that's asking you to do it, at this level, it is your instincts asking you to do it, and you're no longer split. Where in this level, if you come across people who are lascivious, who are pleasure-seeking, who are greedy, you risk being destabilized. Because you really want that. You just tell yourself, it's wrong. I'm not going to have it. That's the passage in India as I read it.
It seems to me that what it's really about is the intention with which anything is being done, because even something that looks good out to me, out to the outer world, is not a healthy thing for the person who's doing it.
Not if you are trying to get through to this level of integration.
Right.
No.
I mean, you could be the CEO of a nonprofit, but it's such an ego-driven thing that it really isn't a healthy thing for you.
Right, and you can see it in the resentment.
Right, even though externally other people might see it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just labeling certain things we say are this and certain things we say are that. And how can we possibly strengthen the intention of the individual?
Or I would say here at this third level, it springs from the intentionality of your own will.
Right.
It's just, you just can't help but give it.
Right.
Like, I mean, there you can see a little child who just gives joyously. Mm-hmm. Here, have my banana. That's what you get back to. And where we are now in this text is we're working on the unio mentalis, because that house has to be softened with the blood. That's getting to the unio corporalis. You could say with a little bit of oversimplification, that the unio corporalis is making real what you've understood. It's not quite right. It's a little simple, but because you do make real. If you want to stop drinking, if you're an addict and you get control of your behavior, that's real. That would be the unio mentalis. The unio corporalis would be if you can go back and be comfortable with the emotions that used to drive you to drink and not and feel them and not drink.
I just have a question, Gary. You're kind of going, we've talked about spiraling.
Yeah.
I mean, are there, I mean, I feel like in different ways I've done different
things. It's a spiral, definitely.
Right, but I'm just saying, like with my food addictions or different things, you know, where you come back, so there's different maybe parts of your life that, that you go through these stages.
Sure.
And then maybe this
yeah.
part and
yeah.
different things.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Can the spiral be upward as well as downward, or downward as well as upward?
I think it generally goes down and then goes up.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what I like so much is the way Jung, now see, this is Jung at the end of his life. You don't hear this stuff before those heart attacks. This is that light that came out of that, of his nights, of his visions in 1944. It's a reconnection of his psychology with the outer world. And how does that work? So important, I think.
Could you say, Gary, because the way Campbell, excuse me, but I'm taking a class on him, so it's so fresh in my mind, but what he says is that what you end up in is compassion. He said that's, this, he would say at this stage.
Yeah, that's compassion.
To a period of compassion. And he would say the reason is because you realize thou art that.
Mm-hmm.
But as you look out, we're all one.
Mm-hmm.
So we see ourselves everywhere we mm-hmm. where we are, and so it's just this natural...
Yeah.
It's not even, it's just instinctively
yeah.
who you are at that point.
Remember, the conjunctio is the archetype of love.
So, and Jung would talk about that that oneness as well, right? A universal oneness?
That's the unis mundus.
You would accept that.
Now, he doesn't take it in such a, I'm not sure how Campbell means it, but in such a cosmological sense, but more as an individual that you're trying to accomplish something in life. And it's at this point that doors start opening to you, and that you have something to give to those doors that have opened to you. I think it's the foundation of real generosity. That's how I would put it. Compassion, I think, is very close. Right. It's just not done out of morality. And people like that can say yes, and they can say no. I mean, it's okay. But if you're doing it out of morality, you feel guilty if you say no. Well, the passage then, 317, we've pretty much looked at. The elders looking on the brightness of the sun and the moon.
Where are we on? 327?
Sorry, what did I say? I meant to say 327. I thought I'm getting dyslexic. I'm writing numbers backwards. Can you get dyslexic older in life?
I've never heard of that.
I felt like it rubbed off from my
head. Very
strange. Maybe I got it from you.
I mean, I swear it feels contagious. It does.
It's kind of fun. You don't worry about how things go together. You just, oh, just number
it
you're up.
It frees
you
from having to be right all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's like, oh, that's my dyslexia, man.
Yeah. 327, that's the passage we did. The reason I spent a lot of time on this business of the conjunctio, because we will see it through the end. We're just looking at the first stage here. And it's the first time he mentions unio mentalis. She mentions unio mentalis.
Sherry, one other question. Could you call that first step the identification of the complex?
Identification of the complex?
So what you're pulling out then, and what's interesting then is what that means is that there's going to be more than one, so it's not like it's an ever-finished process.
That's what Carl said, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's
that's
a spiral.
Same thing.
It's mm-hmm. a spiral. But I do think you do, you know, the first time around is tougher. And you do, you think, this will never go anywhere. And sure enough, if you can hang in there, it does, and it gives you a sort of an inner buoyancy that, okay, I'll try it again. And each time, something more accrues on the inside. More love, more compassion, more patience, more generosity. Yeah, it's, I think it's both a spiral, and there is a certain accruing to it.
And I think what you said, I don't know if it's last week or the week before, about Marion Woodman, that she said, you know, she individuated because of her
right.
reading disorders.
Right.
So it's in that dark place that leads you to begin to realize
yeah.
what's going on and
yeah.
wanting to not live your life that way anymore, but how am I going to do that?
Right.
That first stage of It's so tormenting.
Would that have been her destiny? Would that plan already have been there?
I think so. Yeah. And you can see how, I mean, she's probably a good example, how she developed into herself. And the lessons she learned along the way were exactly the lessons the culture needed to hear as it tries to move forward into the feminine. So you can see how these things, that's a pretty good example of the unus mundus. Mm-hmm. These things aren't separate. Your own inner journey and where the culture needs to go run a parallel. Now, it's not like, she enjoys making money. She charges a lot of money probably for her dogs. It's not that you're like in this missionary thing, but that her basic contribution to the world is positive because of the resonance between her and the times. And that, to me, is what we're aiming for. Your own development at first seems awfully lonely, but it begins to bring you back to the world on the basis of who you are. And the world is ready for learning how you have grown in your journey, because that's how it needs to grow. And then you can help it. Help others grow. So that's 327.
Mary, it was funny, the last time she got up to talk, she started actually by saying, every time I get up here, I wonder if I'm going to have anything to say. Which I just, so that I love that.
It's, yeah. That's the humility.
Exactly. That's, it's like she's so in it, she's just like, well, I hope something comes out.
Well, I was reading in that Conscious Femininity towards the end of it, she was talking about that she was no longer doing lectures in a linear way, so she did not really... She had some ideas she wanted to cover, but she didn't quite know how they were going to come out at each lecture, and it was so like a surprise to her as well as everybody else as to how it worked.
Mm-hmm. Just see, we have just a little bit of time left what to do. I'll just touch on a couple of points here, and then we'll pick up. Page 328. The lamb is referenced. And 331, the description of the houses indicated there on top of 331. All images we've seen, right?
331, were you on?
Yeah.
I went and looked up who the 24 elders were. You know, she refers to this place in Jung, and he talks about them being the good and the bad qualities in our character. Mm-hmm. So I just thought I'd pass that little bit of looking up along.
I don't even zoom through this. 332. There are 14 cornerstones to this house. And she on 332, describes them to mean the virtues required of the alchemist. And that goes on for quite a ways. I would just single them out. 332, it's humility, holiness, and chastity. 1, 2, 3. Fifth is virtue. Yeah, thank you. And then victory. Page 335, the seventh is faith. Eighth is hope. The ninth is charity. Tenth is goodness. Eleventh is patience. There is 12. I've lost it already.
And this is followed by temperance, so I would guess that's 12. Or, no, it's
12 is temperance.
Temperance. 13th is spiritual discipline. 14th is obedience. What I think I just have you get a, take away from there is that you have to have morality to do this work. It presupposes you are an ethical person, which, believe me, today seems more and more rare. I'm amazed at things people do. It doesn't bother them. That takes us over to 337. And we're almost done with this chapter. We'll pick up at 337. And how much is on the seventh? I think you could probably read the whole sixth parable the next time. I don't know if we'll get through it. But I found it a little confusing, the sixth parable.
You better bring wine to the next one.
Okay, good. See you in two.